We are going to have to control her with that.
Or I would be offended.
There you go.
Open up the House Committee on Human Services today, Wednesday, February 18th, 2009. And I will open the public hearing on House Bill 2442. Representative Gelser, do you want to come out and tell us about your bill?
Yes. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state representative from House District 16, which includes Corvallis, Philomath, and two people in Linn County who have never voted for me.
Keep trying.
When there's only two people, you know. I have to acknowledge this is the first time in a very long time I have been nervous in front of a committee. This is a very important bill to me. It's probably because Representative Maurer is on the committee and he might hurt me. That would be unfortunate.
We'll restrain him.
I'll restrain him.
All right, thank you. No individual, regardless of disability, should worry about whether they are safe in their own home. In 2007, the Oregonian published a disturbing series about the high incidence of abuse and neglect of adults with developmental disabilities living in publicly financed group and foster homes in Oregon. It found that 1 in 5 adults with developmental disabilities in the residential care system had been victims of serious cases of abuse between 2000 and 2007. Half of these were seriously victimized more than once, and 14 of them died. Since publication of the Oregonian reports, I am personally aware of 2 additional deaths due to abuse or neglect in publicly paid care. One of them was a constituent of mine. What kind of abuses are we talking about? The newspaper documented, for example, the use of electric dog collars to control behaviors. Other people with disabilities were poked with sticks, burned with cigarettes, locked in rooms, or left sitting for hours in urine, vomit, and fecal matter. One victim was repeatedly grabbed and pinched in the scrotum by his care provider, while another was threatened with a knife, bound with 2-inch clear packing tape, pushed to the floor, and kicked by the person paid with public dollars to care for them. In one of the instances, which I found most heartbreaking because it spoke to the vulnerability of this population of people, it was an individual who struck a client on the forehead with an open palm while that individual was sitting on the toilet. Last February, we made an effort to take some first steps to respond to this issue by creating a searchable database that would allow people with disabilities and their families to learn more about the abuse history of those who cared for them. We ran out of time to pass that bill, and not without extraordinary efforts on the part of many individuals in this room, including Chair Tomei and also notably now U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley. In the meantime, we learned important new information through our hearing process. Representative Olson, Representative Maurer, and others asked some really good questions that helped us better understand the issues related to this bill. For instance, we learned that as heinous as these abuses are, few of them are investigated by law enforcement, and even fewer are prosecuted in a court of law. In our interim work group, we learned that of the cases that rise to the level of a crime that are referred to local law enforcement agencies by the Department of Human Services, law enforcement responds only in about 15% of those cases. In the case that I referenced above with the individual who was repeatedly grabbed in the scrotum and injured, that case was given to law enforcement and the prosecutor, and the prosecutor declined prosecution. As a result, perpetrators are able to move from job to job without a criminal conviction, seeking out new victims and bringing tragedy into the lives of still more vulnerable adults, and not to mention giving a bad name to the vast number of care providers. The vast majority of individuals who care for vulnerable adults in our communities are people who are in it. It's a service of the heart. Nobody goes into this job because it's easy or because it pays well, because it does not. So, again, the vast majority of people who are doing these services are extraordinary individuals. Over the course of the past year, in addition to the months leading up to the February session, I have been working closely with a diverse group of stakeholders to develop this legislation, which will keep repeat abusers away from vulnerable adults, hold these predators accountable when they do commit abuse, create transparency and better consumer protection in the system, engage the public safety system, and ultimately prevent future abuse from occurring. The bill has undergone significant study and many changes at the request of dozens of individuals whose fingerprints are on this proposal. There are simply too many people that have worked very hard on this to name. Last summer, I convened a work group which, at its height, had more than 40 people participating. They represented service providers, labor advocates, self-advocates, human services advocates, law enforcement, protective service workers, the Department of Human Services, district attorneys, defense attorneys, nonprofit providers, the Department of Justice, the Sexual Assault Task Force, and more. When it became clear that the legislative draft, the actual language, would not be back in time to share with stakeholders, I didn't actually receive it until a couple of weeks ago, I went on the road and conducted over 20 different information sessions to share what the legislative request had been, to seek feedback and solicit concerns. As a result, there were multiple changes made to the bill even while it was still being drafted in legislative council, and for that I am really grateful to Lori Freeman for her ongoing flexibility as I kept changing the legislative request. In the end, I believe this is a very good product. Not everyone loves every piece, but that would be a standard that would be impossible to achieve. Instead, I believe that this bill represents a fair balance between the interests of all parties, while most importantly keeping as its focus the safety of vulnerable adults. In a minute, I will walk you through the bill section by section. You should have a document at the dais that I've given to you, but let me conclude these opening remarks with this. We are talking about extraordinarily vulnerable people. Nationwide, we know that over 80% of adult women with developmental disabilities will be raped or sexually abused in their lifetimes. Half of these women, half of these 80%, will be victimized 10 times or more, usually by people who know them and have some sort of responsibility for providing caregiving supports to them, paid or unpaid. Yet our response to these issues in Oregon, and to be fair, everywhere, has been rather modest. As stated before, few of these crimes against vulnerable adults are ever even prosecuted. And current civil penalties assessed for substantiated allegations of abuse of a person with a disability, even for things like rape or death, can be smaller than the statutory minimum fines for confinement of a pregnant pig or animal cruelty. That is absolutely unconscionable. A single case of rape, physical abuse, or financial exploitation of people with developmental disabilities is too many. 4,648 substantiated cases in 7 years is more than shameful, and it should be our call to immediate action. We cannot let another session pass without having time to pass this bill. I hope you will join me in supporting this legislation so that we can take the first steps towards improving the safety of these vulnerable adults in our community. So you have, it's a big bill, I recognize that, and so I gave you a big handout, or several of them. And so if you look at this one, it's called Protecting Vulnerable Adults, the overview. And I'm going to quickly take you through what each of the sections are.
I don't think we have that.
Madam Chair, I don't have it.
Yeah, we don't have it. Some of us don't have it over here.
Madam Chair, while we're waiting to get that to you, I think they're in the back. Is it all right if I start?
Yes. You know what I didn't do, Representative, was have Keeley read the essence of the bill. Should we do that first?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. This bill establishes the Quality Care Fund, designates the fund to the Department of Human Services for the creation and maintenance of a consumer information database for developmental disability services and for training, technical assistance, quality improvement initiatives, and licensing activities. It mandates that the database be searchable and contain information on substantiated complaints of abuse in long-term care, residential facilities, and adult foster homes. It requires that these facilities provide written notice to clients of the database's availability and of substantiated allegations of abuse within their home. It requires establishes an investigative office within DHS, directs county district attorneys to develop disciplinary teams for developing investigative and communications protocols relating to vulnerable adults, expands definitions in the Elderly Persons and Persons with Disabilities Abuse Prevention Act.
Thank you.
All right. So in Section 1 of the bill, this is what establishes the Quality Care Fund. For those of you that were on this committee in 2008, the language will be very similar. This takes the new fines and civil penalties and licensing fees, which come up later in the bill, and directs all of them into this Quality Care Fund. In this bill, the monies in that Quality Care Fund can be used only. It self-pays for the database that we talk about, but also for quality improvement initiatives and provider training, things that are going to help reduce abuse. Right now, those general, the fines, civil penalties, licensing fees that come in go to the big general fund in the sky. And particularly for those fines and civil penalties, we'd like to see that go directly towards preventing abuse in the future. And you'll hear later from the individuals who will be paying those fines, civil penalties, and licensing fees who are, in fact, supporting this. We've negotiated that very carefully. Section 2 creates the Consumer Information Database for Developmental Disabilities Services. It requires that clients be notified about how to report suspected abuse. It also requires that everyone be notified how to access the database and that the database exists. Again, if you were here last year, you will note that it's very similar. What is different is we have removed the individual provider name. You would not search by, you know, Sarah Gelser to see what my history was. Instead, you would search by the name of the Oak Foster Care Facility at 5740 West Oakey Boulevard, and you'd be able to see the history of that particular business, which actually provides some important information to a family that's looking for a placement, because you can see what the history of that business is. One of the proposed amendments to this bill is to add some language noting that the abuse definitions and the investigation processes will change as a result of this bill, since the data would go back to 2003. It is important to populate the database with some data. If it's empty, then it's not very useful. Section, and stop me as we go along if you have questions, please.
Representative, I have a question.
Yes.
This could be a long morning. So if Ms. or Mr. X had committed an abuse and it would not go in the database as his abuse of a patient, so how, that person could move on to another facility, right?
We address that issue in two other parts of the bill in two different ways, and I'll be sure to flag that for you
Thank
when
you.
We get to that part.
Great.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. Representative Gelser, do you address in here in-home care if it's not connected with facility?
No. Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, at this point, we do not. However, through a point that we're going to flag a little bit later, there will be the ability for consumers to access information about individuals they might be hiring and inviting into their homes to provide care in a different section of the bill.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Maurer.
Thanks. And the information will be in the database permanently?
Representative Tomei. Representative Maurer, yes, it would be in the database permanently, only substantiated allegations. It's not any accusation that's made. It's only that that has been substantiated.
That's a long time, permanently.
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, it is a long time. However, I would point to other legislation we're working on in the building that relates to teacher abuse. That information remains in a record for a very long time. And in terms of school children, we're talking about a much smaller number of individuals who have been victimized. In this case, I think at least the same standard should apply.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow up with what Representative Maurer just talked about for that. So I'm looking at the possibility of expungement. Any discussion at all of that when you were visiting with the district attorneys on this issue? Because you do mention that it will be permanently maintained. Assault 4 and some of your smaller felonies mm-hmm. actually do have a lifespan that are, you know, subject to being able to be removed.
Correct. Madam Chair, Representative Olson, these are not crimes. These are basically licensing activities. This is a substantiation of an abuse. And if you remember, we're going to get to the criminal section of this bill later. Right now, this is only about the substantiated allegations within the Department of Human Services through that abuse investigation system.
Okay. Okay, we better move along or else we're never going to get
one quick
to,
question.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since you brought it up, Representative, do you address secret deals in this?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Huffman. You and I have had lots of opportunities to talk about secret deals in recent days in our not-so-secret meetings. We don't use that language in here, but there is language later on which what I have heard from the providers is they right now feel stuck in providing accurate references to potentially new employers that call them and say, I'm about to hire Alice Snow. What is their history? Right now, they feel like they would have civil liability if they said, she was substantiated for abuse while she worked for me. This bill protects them from that liability and allows that information to happen. This is information that the providers want to exchange about these individuals, so I believe that giving them that protection is going to make that happen.
Thank you, because I do see a lot of parallel between these works.
Thank you, Representative.
Continue, please.
Right, thank you. So Section 3 requires the date of notice to current residents about the database existing. It's just a date. It's updated from 2007 because the effective date has now passed since we're a year later now. In Section 4 requires the Department of Human Services to report to the appropriate committees of the Legislative Assembly about the rate of abuse and the types of training that happen for abuse providers. One of the things that I think was frustrating to many of us that were surveying last year when the reports came out in the Oregonian was that the legislature was not aware that this was an ongoing and persistent problem. That's something that we should be aware of so that we're able to tackle that. And even though there is not currently there isn't currently a requirement for that report to be provided to the legislature, that report is currently provided. It breaks down all the information county by county and by type of abuse. So this is information that's currently sitting in the Department of Human Services. This would allow that information to leave those walls and come to us here so that we're able to better understand it. And current administrative rule also requires that a central record of abuse be maintained. And the other piece that's important to add is that current law also says that all of that information about substantiated abuse is a public record permanently. And there will be an amendment to this that clarifies that the report is focused only on adults with developmental disabilities. So there's two service types. There's another sheet you have there that's probably doesn't make a lot of sense that lists what the current amendments are. It pulls out a couple of service types that are confusing, and we want to add some data that makes it clear this is just developmental disabilities. Section 5 requires the department to provide notice to a facility when abuse is substantiated. So if they've come, they've done an investigation, and something has happened in your facility, we're going to make sure that you know about it. And we're also going to require after that for the facility to provide notice to the residents, all of the residents, so that if Sue lives in a group home and there's been sexual assault in that group home, she's going to know and her case manager is going to know not who it was or the facts of the event, but that there has been an instance of abuse. And again, please remember that these are places where individuals live, so they need to have access about the safety of their home. It's also requiring facilities and others, so in-home care and other types of providers, to ask on the job application whether a person has ever had an allegation of abuse substantiated against them by the Department of Human Services. And what's not listed here but is in this section is requiring that the department notify the individual who has been substantiated for abuse, the person that has committed the abuse. We need to make sure that they actually know that they have been substantiated for abuse. That's important if we're going to ask them later to disclose this. Section 6 talks about criminal records checks. There will be a significant change here. The intention was to give the department the authority and the ability to keep fingerprint records on file. There's a lot of turnover, and many people may move from job to job. And for some classes of workers, depending on how long they've lived in the state, every time they change their jobs, they have to get fingerprinted again, which is very expensive. When I talked with the criminal records unit, Mr. Buckley there told me that about two-thirds of the work that he does on fingerprints is duplicative of fingerprints they've already run. And if they could hold on to these, it would cut that down. To address the privacy concerns, there is an opt-out if you prefer to pay your fee and keep getting fingerprinted because you're concerned about the government having your fingerprints on file. We've accommodated for that. You can just say, no, I don't want you to have them. This will also clarify, this was not intended to expand the number of of fingerprints or the types of people that the department is required to fingerprint. I know that we can't afford that right now, so there will be an amendment that clarifies that all this does is give that permissive authority to the department to hold on to those fingerprints. Also doesn't tell them they have to do it. The bill also, and you can refer, there's another piece of paper here that you see. Currently, when doing a criminal background check, the process in the Department of Human Services is to do a weight check or a weight test when there's a criminal conviction, when they do that criminal background check prior to employment. And they will say, okay, there was this crime, it's been this long, this is how it relates to this position, and then they decide on a case-by-case basis whether or not that person should be employed. Certain kinds of crimes, they have to weigh it for a longer period of time than others. However, there are no statutory exclusions for working as a direct care provider. So in the state of Oregon, it might be hard to get through the weight test, but currently, without this change in law, it would be legal to hire someone who previously had been convicted of rape or homicide to work as a direct care provider. In the public school system, again, there is a whole list. There's a whole list in statute of crimes that if you have committed them, you are permanently barred from working in a public school building. And we do this, the policy intention behind that is that children are very vulnerable. But if you think about school kids, kids are in a very public place in large groups with all of their clothes on in front of other people. If you look at this population of people, these are very vulnerable people who are alone and oftentimes have no clothes on, receiving very intimate care behind closed doors. It only makes sense that we would provide the same level of protection to this vulnerable group of people as we do in other sets. The crimes that you'll see, I've listed them out so that you can know what they are instead of having to go to the statute book to see them. These are all big bad things. There are no drug crimes in this list of statutory prohibitions, with the exception of manufacture and delivery of a controlled substance. You have to be clean for 10 years after you have cooked the meth or run the cocaine. So again, it's not the use, it's the manipulating and causing other vulnerable people to use that. The amendment will pull out. There was also a 10-year window on domestic violence, and we're pulling that out because we do know that in some cases where there's a domestic violence situation, the victim themselves may be in an altercation and have a charge on their record, and we don't want to punish those folks in that way. There are questions before I move on? The last piece is that last session we passed a bill that was called House Bill 2175 that allows the department to have a big database inside the department that is not publicly available that keeps track of substantiated abuse across the entire agency, so child welfare, mental health, developmental disabilities, seniors, so that we don't have people moving from silo to silo. And so when the department does a background check, eventually they will be able to run against that and see if there is a prior substantiated abuse. And what this section of the bill, and this goes to Representative Huffman's previous question, when you're hiring someone with public funds, that background check is required to be done. And so this says that when the department gets to that point where they're able to do this, and again, it doesn't force them to do it on a certain date, it's when they have this capacity to start doing this under the bill that we already passed, they must notify that potential employer, even if it's an individual that's hiring someone on their own rather than through an agency, that there has been a substantiated allegation of abuse. The privacy issue is addressed because we've already asked them to disclose this on their job application, and it is already a public record. Section 7 is probably the most contentious part of the bill. This section in the form that you have in front of you, it says that it creates the Offices of Investigations and Training, which already exists. That's something that needs to change. There's no other place in statute where an agency within the Department of Human Services is identified in statute, so we definitely want to fix that. The intention with this came from the testimony that we received last February, where advocates and providers and labor were very concerned that from county to county, the way that abuse investigations are done are very different. In some cases, individuals who are doing protective service investigations are also working as case managers or foster care licensors, and this creates enormous conflicts of interest. And that not everyone was necessarily being trained to the same standards or had the same competency requirements. And so the idea that came out of that, we talked about that last February, was centralizing everything to the Office of Investigations and Training so that we would know what substantiated for abuse in Benton County would also be substantiated in Wallowa County. There have been a number of different concerns that have been raised about this by a whole variety of people, and I think you have before you some language that came from James Taves that we're working with, and I talked with Multnomah County yesterday, and this was more comfortable to them as well. Instead of centralizing, instead of pulling the function all the way back to the state, it would put into statute new contract language that the department was working to move forward with that would just stay in statute. You must have a dedicated FTE to doing the investigations. You cannot be an investigator and a case manager. There are also new problems with that for Medicaid reimbursement. And it also would give the department the authority in that contract to make sure that individuals have the appropriate competencies to be able to...
Madam Chair.
You know, I'm concerned we're not going to get through this. Can you? Do you think you can hold on to that, or is that important that you answer it
right
now?
Yes, ma'am. I can hold.
Thank you.
Great. The other thing that's in this, and my understanding from the contract language before, and perhaps I'm anticipating where Representative Maurer is going, there are some counties where it's not possible to have a full FTE for an abuse investigator, and there would still be flexibility for regionalization and other ways to make that happen. But the point is, this is a very important function. People have to be appropriately trained, and if we're going to have people have employment consequences, if providers are going to have potential liability for hiring people, and if victims are going to be safe, we have to know that we can trust that process. And I think that that was something loud and clear last February, that there is a lack of trust in the current investigation process.
Madam Chair, actually, it is very relevant. I apologize.
Okay, go.
Is my concern is when you have the county developmental disabilities program are the same people that actually provide the care. They do both sides of it. You can't be the person investigated and the investigator, even under this scenario.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, and again, that was part of the point of this, and if you would, I would be happy to work with you offline as we get this amendment the right way to make sure that that is clearly addressed. We want to remove any potential conflict of interest from the role of that investigator.
Well, we're stopped, Representative. I'm concerned. We've spent a half hour, and we're on Section 7, and I think there are, 49 sections?
Most of them are very short. We're through most of the meat of it now.
Oh, okay.
They get lots later. It's the fees. And
okay, and we have 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 people are wanting to testify.
There's more, too. I'm sorry.
There are more. Okay. Go ahead.
All right. So Section 8 creates county multidisciplinary teams for vulnerable adults. This gets to the piece where we're wanting to bring law enforcement and public safety to the table in addressing what is really a public safety issue. These are not human service issues. These are crimes, and we need our law enforcement community to be involved in the discussion. A couple of important things to note about the multidisciplinary team. It creates the function and the structure for that. It gives them the ability for the agencies to share information with each other. But it does not require any meetings. So it's basically giving the counties a tool, but it is not giving them a mandate that they must have this meeting every month. It gives them a tool that we hope that they will take advantage of. I believe we have someone here today that's going to talk about a federal grant that is funding these types of activities in Multnomah and Clackamas County. And this piece is based on some work that was done in Massachusetts that vastly increased the number of criminal prosecutions in these cases. And there's now federal law that's based on this as well, which is where that grant money came from. Section 9 required a similar report to the legislature from these county multidisciplinary teams. I think it's going to come out. It's basically redundant to the report that you saw in Section 4, and the Department of Human Services already collects information about law enforcement response and the prosecution rates, so we'll already have that data. Section 10 updates the senior and physical disability abuse statute to align with 430-735, which is the developmental disability and mental health abuse statute. The idea is to have these mirror each other and have the same level of protections available to both. It's also to make sure that what's currently an administrative rule, we heard testimony from the department last February that they are currently substantiating beyond the authority of statute because their administrative rules are more aggressive. This creates some concern consistency there. Really important amendments here. We are completely removing any references to vulnerable adult and restoring all of the original definitions of elderly person and person with disability. So there's no change here except for the definitions. We're also in the definitions of neglect and exploitation, adding the word significant in front of the type of physical injury or psychological harm to make sure that this is very significant harm. Section 12 requires that abuse always be immediately reported, allows law enforcement to have access to the victim, and also starts to require some timelines of communication. And these requirements sunset after 5 years. It basically says we want law enforcement to confirm to DHS that they've received the allegation and to let them know whether or not they're going to pursue a criminal investigation. We sunset these requirements after 5 years. I believe that if we give people the prompts and help them work together in this way, after the 5 years it will become second nature, and then individual communities can adjust those timelines in the way that fits for that community. Section 14 is some restating of previous language, but it also requires that the district attorney's office notify the Department of Human Services when they decide to or not to prosecute a case that has been forwarded to them by law enforcement that originated in their department. Section 16, right now, if you are an elderly person or a person with a physical disability, you have a right of civil action to recover damages. This increases that minimum award from $500 to $1,000. And it extends that same right to people with developmental disabilities and mental illness. They are also adults, and they should have the same rights when they are abused as elderly and people with physical disabilities. Section 17 extends this right if the vulnerable person dies as a result of abuse, that their estate can sue for that death. Section 18 is where it's the secret agreement apart. I don't believe there are secret agreements in the DD system, but this allows the disclosure of the substantiated abuse to be made to a prospective employer. Section 19 will be deleted because this will come as a surprise to all of you, but the state has no money to do new things. This would have created a forensic investigator in the Attorney General's office. Hopefully this is something we can come back to someday when the economy turns around. Section 20 really mirrors the section on, this is the DD side of that abuse statute, so it mirrors it, and the language changes in the proposed amendments would be the same. Vulnerable adult goes away, and the previous definition of adult returns. Section 21 makes sure that whoever's doing the investigations, there's clear communication with the case managers. Section 22 is very important because it requires that the investigation be completed even if the suspected abuser resigns or is terminated. This is very important for future employers to have that information in the database. And much of this is further repeat language from other sections. And again, Section 24 again allows that disclosure of substantiated abuse. The following sections are all identical to House Bill 3617, and this is where you see the licensing fees, the civil penalty increases. The change in the civil penalty is to a $2,500 minimum in cases of rape, sexual assault, serious injury, and death, that the minimum fine for that would be $2,500. And that is the really big, enormous bill with lots of sections in it in a quick overview. And I'm happy to answer any questions, though I know there are many people who are eager to tell you what they think about this.
Yes. Representative Cowan, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gelzer. And Madam Chair, just because it's been referred to frequently throughout this conversation, could you define substantiated for me?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Cowan. In order to substantiate an allegation of abuse, there needs to be an investigation, and the evidence needs to show that a reasonable person would conclude that the majority of the evidence showed that the event did occur.
You know what, I think for some of the new people on the committee, I know we heard this last year, talk a little bit about why some of these supposed substantiated crimes have not been prosecuted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a good question, and it's one that we wrestled with in our work group, and I was surprised with what the answer was. I had assumed that they're hard cases to prosecute, and so the district attorneys would choose not to move forward with them. What we found instead is that the missing link is at the very beginning where a criminal investigation isn't taking place. That's part of the purpose in this bill of having this increased communication between the department and law enforcement to try to figure out, are these things not being having criminal investigations because similar crimes against non-disabled people are also not being investigated because the resources aren't there at the community? Is it because there's a misunderstanding about how adult abuse is investigated? We've got great collaboration between the Department of Human Services and local law enforcement agencies on child abuse. We rarely prosecute cases of child abuse in court, which I personally think is kind of a sad thing, particularly in the cases of physical abuse. But there are services that come from the department, and the way that the child is made safe is through services that are provided. It's a very different system for adults because there isn't a family to provide services to. You just move that perpetrator to somebody else, someplace else in the system. I think that when there is this increased communication, that one will probably learn that some of these things wouldn't have been investigated even if the person wasn't disabled. But I also think that there will be a greater awareness in some communities about how important these prosecutions are, and that it may seem like one person, but there's this ripple effect like in a pond because these perpetrators offend and offend and offend again. And so I think that this bill has great potential to help stop that and in that way prevent abuse in the future.
Great. Thank you. Representative Dunbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm actually following up on Representative Cowan back to the substantiation issue that's weighing on our minds in so many settings. Can you speak to, or perhaps there's someone else who can speak to, the actual process that DHS uses to assure substantiation? The bill talks about a DHS process. Is that something you can speak to?
I can. Thank you, Chair Tomei and Representative Dunbrough. That's part of the point of Section 7, is to ensure that we have standards all the way across the state that are consistent for that investigation and substantiation process. I have great confidence in the Office of Investigations and Trainings, which does many of these across the state. Eva Kutas is the director there, and we are so lucky to have her in the state. Her competency and professionalism and creativity are extraordinary. I think that this will help that. One of the challenges, you and I and some others on this committee have been engaged in this discussion in another setting. The challenge here is that you don't get licensed to be a direct care provider. We license teachers, we license tanning bed operators, but we do not license people that provide these types of direct supports to individuals. So what we're trying to do is create some consumer protection absent what really is a consumer protection activity, which is a licensing board.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, is there some documentation somewhere,
follow up.
On the actual process, that the standard process that a DHS investigation would follow?
Chair Tomei, Representative Dunbrough, yes, there is, and I can get that to you after the meeting if you'd like.
That would be great. And
thank
just
you.
One more follow-up, and this goes back to the expungement question. So, I understand, and I certainly am in agreement that people with disabilities need to be protected from potential predators. But if somebody has gone through a legal system and has been found to be able to work in that kind of setting, and I don't know if that's often the conditions of a settlement, this may be in many cases the only job they can do. And if there is a high level of confidence that they would not abuse again, this is going to bar them from ever having that kind of livelihood. And I'm just wondering about that.
Chair Tomei, Representative Dunbrough, I think there's two places that question goes to. One is to clarify that database does not have individual provider names in it. And what that gives you is really a history of the types of trainings and supports that are potentially available within that business. And what you see is a pattern over time, and that's why it's important to keep it there. In terms of the prohibited crimes, if you read through the crimes and see what these are very high-level kinds of crimes. I don't believe believe that it is the job of people with developmental disabilities to risk their lives and safety, to give individuals who have been convicted of rape or murder or abandonment or strangulation or robbery a second chance. I also think that, honestly, if I were to think of inviting someone into my home, and a lot of times these are folks that are, I mean, these are the places where people live, would you choose to invite someone with that criminal background to come and care for your newborn child, for your teenager, for your elderly loved one? What would your comfort level be with that? We don't allow it in public schools. I don't think that we should allow it for these most vulnerable people.
Thank you. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a clarification on licensing. We license the facility, but the actual care providers do not have licenses. Is that what you said?
Chair Tomei, Representative Van Orman, that is correct.
Thanks.
Representative Huff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gelser, I'd like to point out for the record that I was not the one that brought up substantiated. Whole nother story. I would like to see you come back with Son of Sarah Bill. That would, and I may get strung out for this, but I've had some personal family experiences with it. This is a critical area of vulnerable people, whether they're disabled or elderly, just elderly, and otherwise have all their capacity. But at 85 years old, they need somebody to come into their home and help care for them. I would love to see a licensure established where every caregiver other than a family member had to be licensed and have a background check, because not everybody works for the state in in-home care. Not everybody is under the purview of DHS. There are a lot of private individuals out there that a lot of them are good, but there are a number of them, like, say, based on personal experience, that prey on elderly and end up in a relatively short period of time actually getting their entire estates signed over and in their control, and that's reprehensible. And anyway, Son of Sarah Bill.
Well, Representative, you still have two priority bills. There you go.
Yeah.
Any quick questions? Thank you so much, Representative Gelser. I'm going to call up Catherine White, Judy Cuneo, and Bill Lynch, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon DD Coalition, which is a coalition of approximately 26 organizations, including providers, families, self-advocates, and other advocates. And we're here in support of House Bill 2442, based on some of the proposed amendments and some of the discussion. We believe this is an important part of a holistic approach to the kind of abuse and neglect that's often experienced by people with developmental disabilities. Because we're a coalition of stakeholders, we've had some very intense conversations about this bill. We're stakeholders who come at this issue from very different viewpoints. We debated how to approach the issues of abuse and neglect, who should do it, how it should be done. We developed a paper entitled Improving Protective Services for Adults with Developmental Disabilities Through Reorganization and Enhancement. We spent a lot of time talking about this issue, looking at what the possible options would be. Obviously,
I'm going to stop you for a minute. Somebody has a cell phone on or a BlackBerry, and it affects the speaker system. If you could turn it not just on vibrate, but turn them completely off. Would you please check your system? Somebody has one on that's affecting it.
Okay, Catherine. We worked with Representative Gelser during the interim. We have submitted recommendations for amendments, and that we understand will be incorporated in a final draft. We believe this bill identifies many of the things that we identified as major issues and potential solutions. The Quality Care Fund that would use the licensing fees. We believe the bill begins to address the issues of transparency by the creation of the database and reporting. We support the multidisciplinary teams at the local level and bringing the abuse definitions together in statute. What is particularly important to us is the centralization of training and accountability, because the inconsistency around the state in abuse investigations was a major concern to families as well as a major concern to providers. We believe that these measures will help start addressing some of the significant issues that we have in the system.
Thank you.
Catherine. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Lynch, and I'm here as the director of the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. The council is a federally funded to advise state government and advocate for improvements in the system of services for people with developmental disabilities. Members of our council are appointed by the governor, and at least 60% of them, of the 25 members, are people with developmental disabilities and family members. The DD Council supports House Bill 2442. Quality assurance of developmental disability services has always been a top priority of the Council. But since November 4th, 2007, it rose from a top priority to the top priority. It was on that dark day in November that the Oregonian began publishing the articles that Representative Gelser referred to, a series of front-page articles about the high rate of abuse and neglect of Oregonians with developmental disabilities. The data was damning. It claimed caregivers had seriously mistreated, abused, neglected 1 in 5 Oregonians with developmental disabilities since the year 2000. While officials cast doubt on the accuracy of the data, no one denied we had a very serious problem on our hands. And I'm here to tell you that that problem has not gone away or grown any less serious. There's been lots of good planning that has occurred since November 2007 to address many of the systemic issues raised by the Oregonian, but very few plans have yet been implemented, and some, such as the scope of the Department of Human Services Do Not Hire Registry, have been scaled back due to budget constraints that you're all aware of. Even this bill has been drafted, redrafted, amended in an effort to make it better and budget neutral. It's now time to take action. As painful as those Oregonian articles on abuse and neglect were, I, for one, welcome them. They cast a light into the dark corners of our developmental disability service system and provoked a public outcry that will surely return in greater volume if nothing is done this session. I want to thank Representative Gelser for her leadership on this important issue, and thank all of you for your careful consideration of this bill. We urge your support.
Thank you, Mr. Lynch. Representative Gelser, I have a request to make of you. Several people have referenced the articles in the Oregonian. Could you ask your staff to find those and email them? Because I think for some of the people, they might not have seen those, and it's also good just for us to remember what those articles were about. Thank you. Hi, welcome back. It's nice to see you.
No.
Madam Tomei, Madam Chair Tomei, and members of the committee. My name is Judy Curio. And I am the self-advocacy coordinator. For the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities.
I'm here to
I am here in support of House Bill
2442.
There are some subjects that are very hard to talk about. For self-advocates, abuse can be very scary to talk about and even think about. People with developmental disabilities are at risk because they are often seen as easy targets. They often won't tell others about it because they are afraid they won't be taken care of any longer. Or because the abuse may even become worse. A lot of times, the victim will take the blame and feel like it is their fault because they did something wrong. No one deserves to be abused. No one. This bill will be the first step to make people with developmental disabilities safer. Thank you.
Thank you, Judy. Appreciate you coming. Any questions of anybody in this panel? Thank you so much. Next we'll call up Eddie. Is it Plood? We've seen you before, Eddie. Joanne Furman and Jean Talke? Teller, you got it.
Madam Chair, as they're coming up, it's very nice to see people that you've seen before.
It is. We're glad they don't give up, aren't we?
Absolutely.
Yeah, sometimes you don't get it first time around. Come on up. Isn't there a third seat? Just bring it on. There you go. Sure. Go ahead, Eddie.
Okay. Madam Chair, Tomain, and members of the committee, my name is Eddie Plurd. I live in Salem, Oregon. I am here. I support HB 2442 because it would stop people who are abusive to people with developmental disabilities from being hired. When I was younger, I was hurt by an abusive caregiver. I was not the first person that the caregiver hurt. He hurt 18 other kids with developmental disabilities. The person that he hurt, that hurt me, did not go to jail. The courts told him that he couldn't be around kids with disabilities. He never should have been hired. This bill would help me to make sure I never hire another abusive caregiver. I would like that the abuse registry to see if the person I want to hire has abused people in the past. This bill will make me feel safe. Please vote to pass HB 2442. Thank you for your time. I appreciate this opportunity to talk to you. I would be happy to try to answer any questions for you might have.
Thank you, Eddie. Nice job. Thank you. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joanne Furman. I'm the Associate Director for Partnerships and Community Living. We're a private nonprofit that supports people in their homes and on the job. We work with over 140 people with developmental disabilities in Polk, Linn, Benton, and Marion counties. I'm also representing the Oregon Rehabilitation Association, which represents nonprofits statewide, providing supports to over 7,000 people with developmental disabilities. Some members of our association are Albertina Kerr, Columbia Gorge, and Shangri-La, just to name a few. The issue of protecting people with developmental disabilities is really important to providers. It's dear to our heart, and it's part of the fundamental reason why we're here, to make sure that people with developmental disabilities live good, healthy, safe lives. So this bill is important to us, which is why we're here in favor of House Bill 2442. We appreciate Representative Gelsler's leadership on this important issue and her willingness to work with all parties to craft a bill that represents the best thinking in our field. I participated in many, many meetings with the association and with other parties, and we know this bill has been greatly modified due to the input from providers and advocates, and we appreciate that hard work, everyone working together to come up with a bill that will work. We support the concept of centralizing abuse investigations at the state level that was originally described in the bill. If that's not the ultimate outcome, we do support Representative Gelsler's request that at a minimum the following is adhered to: dedicated investigators with no other duties, standardized statewide training on a reoccurring schedule, and tight controls and timelines on quality performance reviews. We also support the requirement for DHS to report to a legislator on direct care turnover, pay rates, department-provided training, core competencies required, and the number of substantiated abuse findings. This has been a long process, and I'm sure there'll be more discussion. We'd just like to ask if there are other changes made to the bill in the legislative process that the association be party to discussion about these modifications. So, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Joanne. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jean Tuller, and I'm the project manager for the Building Partnerships Initiative of the ARC of Multnomah Clackamas. I'm here to speak on behalf of House Bill 2442, and first I'd like to thank Representative Gelsler for her leadership in championing this bill. It's of critical importance, I think, to all vulnerable citizens within the state of Oregon. The Building Partnerships Initiative is a two-year project funded through a grant from the United States Department of Justice. The purpose of BPI is to replicate a Massachusetts initiative that links law enforcement, adult protection, human services, and others to address violence committed against persons with disabilities using a coordinated multidisciplinary approach. Oregon is one of only three states in the nation to receive this prestigious grant, which is administered by the Massachusetts Disabled Persons Protection Commission. Massachusetts was chosen to oversee this project because of the extraordinary work that state has done to improve protective services and law enforcement engagement in response to the abuse of individuals with disabilities. The initial focus of BPI activities is in Multnomah County, with statewide implementation planned for year two of the grant cycle. The BPI project is one small forerunner to the legislation introduced by Representative Gelsler that I am pleased to testify on behalf of today. Representative Gelsler's legislation will strengthen law enforcement's activities in instances of the abuse of people with disabilities, create exceptions for sex crimes against vulnerable victims when confession is trustworthy and the victim is incompetent to testify, create multidisciplinary teams in each county, and align the various abuse statutes, among many other laudable goals. And parenthetically, I know that Representative Gelsler has also been interested in the issue of public guardianship, which, as the Arc of Oregon can attest, is critical given that over 50% of the individuals referred to the Arc's Guardianship Advocacy and Planning Services Project are as a result of abuse and neglect. I would like to add my voice to the many here today in sincerely hoping that the Oregon Legislature chooses to vote in the affirmative for this landmark act. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of this legislation.
Thank you for coming. Any questions of this panel? Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Good to see you, Eddie. Okay, so we have Sid's, is it Stellar? Don Bauer, maybe? And James Tate. And you can start your testimony as soon as you identify yourself. Go ahead.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Don Booker. I'm the developmental disability specialist with the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs, and I'm here to testify on in support of House Bill 2442. You have my written testimony. I will abbreviate that in respect for your time.
Thank you.
We agree that the database should be combined with those which already exist in mental health and senior programs. This would prevent offenders from moving laterally within the care system. One concern we initially had was the centralization of investigations. Counties are able to provide the service at a more responsive and timely fashion. We understand that the amendments being introduced by Representative Gelser will remedy this concern. SPD has already drafted new contract language to be effective July 1, 2009. Which would separate the protective service investigation function from the other functions within the county system. We feel the goal of this bill is to ensure that there is a statewide statewide standards for training, competency, and the use of forms and procedures for investigations and writing findings of reported abuse of adults with developmental disabilities. We wish to thank Representative Gelser and her office for working with us on our concerns, and we believe will be addressed in the amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Is it Stellar?
Stellar. Mm-hmm. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Sid Stellar, and I reside with my wife in King City, Oregon. Both of us have served on different boards of nonprofit caregiving agencies for the developmentally disabled. And in addition, we represent families in this state who are members or friends of the Voice of the Retarded, an advocacy organization of national scope. We are very pleased that we are considering this bill today. And I'm just going to just briefly talk now because you have my testimony.
Yes, right.
I know you're going to amend this bill, and I'm sure you'll do a good job with it. I'd like to speak to the licensing fees for residential facilities for vulnerable persons to help finance this fund. The other night on television, I saw that in a Washington constituency next door to us, they are going to put an 18% tax on porno shops. And they interviewed on television one of the owners of one of the porno shops in Vancouver, Washington, and asked the question, what are you going to do with an 18% tax on your establishment? And the lady said, well, we'll just have to move to Oregon. So I was thinking that perhaps we could levy some kind of an inventory tax on porno shops in our state and dedicate it to this quality assurance fund, because We all claim to dislike porno shops. We don't want them around our schools and things of that nature. And I thought it was such a splendid idea, I couldn't help but ad-lib it in here and mention it to you. I wouldn't go to 18%. And I would make provision for those porno shops that are green, that are leaving a very light carbon footprint. because I'm not anti-business, but at the same time, we're strapped for sources of revenue, and I thought this would be a dandy.
Madam Chair.
Oh. You have two.
I was going to say priority bill number two. 100% tax, maybe. I mean, why stop at 18?
Madam Chair,
Representative Maurer, I love the Republicans on this committee. You guys are getting right in there.
I thought we weren't supposed to say that.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
What is it? I love you.
Madam Chair, I love you too.
Hey, we're warm here.
Say, you can hold your breath because you may see something like that. I'm serious. You may see something like that. We can talk after.
All right. I'd like to say that I too have been horrified by the article in the Oregonian, of which I have written in my newsletter a considerable amount in the past year. And I would also say to you that our own daughter has been one of those who have been sexually abused in the past by a caregiver in a state-licensed group home. I'm not so hot on expungement of records simply out of personal reasons. You see, we're going to have to live with her abuse the rest of our life, and she is too. So I think we ought to have a level playing field in that respect. And the people that do these type of things, well, first of all, why didn't we prosecute this person beyond being fired from the establishment? It was because the district attorney told us that our daughter, who is severely handicapped, would not be a reliable witness. Well, there's another bill that will deal with that, and I think you'll be hearing that next week sometime. In any case, we support this bill. It's not a panacea. I'm sure you'll do your best. I certainly urge you to get it out of this committee and onto the floor, and let's see if something can be done in this session. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for coming in. I'm sorry about your daughter, but you're a wonderful advocate for her. Thank you. Any further questions of either of these witnesses? Okay, James, it's nice to see you again.
Madam Chair, James Tays, Department of Human Services, Senior and Disabilities Program. I'll be extremely brief. This bill has lots of moving parts, and we've been working with Representative Gelser and the stakeholders on various amendments and making sure that we look at all the cross-references because we're dealing with multiple populations, multiple statutes, and so we're just carefully examining to make sure there's no unintended consequences, but we're real committed to moving this in a direction that I think the sponsor and the stakeholders want to go in, providing additional protections to vulnerable adults. Just a couple quick comments. The whole licensing fee civil penalty to create a quality assurance fund is a very high priority for the department. In fact, we sponsored a separate bill that now is showing up in this part to do exactly that. Civil penalties are virtually useless at this point in time as an enforcement tool in the state of Oregon. They've not been adjusted since 1977. Some of the most serious types of abuses we can only levy $200 or $300 fine with an aggregate cap of $6,000 per quarter per facility. So we're badly in need of updating that to create better enforcement opportunities, and I think we'll work with the industry and Representative Gelser to make sure that happens. And then creating a quality assurance fund, which after it initially funds the database that is available for ongoing training and technical assistance to help poor-performing providers, I think is a very valuable tool that will help better address quality. I also wanted to talk a little bit about the consistency and how we look at this body of work done between the state and local government. I know there's been a lot of discussion around that. When the abuse statutes for people with developmental disabilities were originally passed many years ago, For whatever reason, we assumed that body of work with no additional staff or fiscal impact at that time. Unlike the senior and physical disability side, where we have dedicated ratios and separate classifications for people who do adult protective services, in our partners with local government, we never had a dedicated workforce specific to protective services. So it was often spread across case managers and other staff. And I think local governments struggled to do the best they could with the resources we gave them. We've long recognized that that needs to be remedied. We've put together a whole different funding formula with local government around this body of work. We've already prepared contractual amendments that will confine this body of work to certain individuals that pass competency-based training requirements that I think will better assure consistency and standardize this process across the state. And then again, we will still at the state level review every single report that's generated through the protective services process to look at that in terms of quality. So I think we're making great strides and have had a lot of input and discussions in moving that process forward. We have not yet completed the fiscal impact. We're still working with Representative Gelser and others on the amendments to see where those end up. So we'll try to provide some timely input on any remaining fiscal issues and also, again, cross-referencing all the statutes to make sure that we don't have other intended consequences. Other than that, we want to work with all of you in moving this forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, James. Any questions of Mr. Tay's representative?
Howard, whatever her name
whoever
is.
Whoever you are down there.
Thank you, Madam Mr. Taves, I'm always interested in the relationship between state direction and local abilities to follow through. So could you just give me a little bit more information about the discussion with the local workforce and dedication? I know you're looking at contractual changes around dedicated individuals for investigation, and Representative Gelser and I have talked a little about that, too. Did I hear you say then that additional funding will come with that to help at the local level? I mean, that's where a concern is for me.
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, we, with local government, reworked the whole funding formula for how we support local government that does eligibility, case management, protective services. And yes, we have enhanced within our existing budget the funding mix that will create a ratio-driven, dedicated workforce that does exclusive protective services work. And then in our contractual requirements, we'll specify what those ratios are. We'll specify those individuals must pass competency-based training requirements set by the state and provide reports and everything based on standardized procedures that are statewide in nature. So all of that, yes, is going to be spelled out contractually, and I think in part is also reflected in Representative Gelser's amendments as well.
Thank you.
Representative Mauer, do you have a question?
One quick question, thanks, Madam Chair, and that is, when was the last time the fees were increased?
Madam Chair, Representative Mauer, the licensing fees, I'm not positive. I know the civil penalties have not been changed since 1977, but the licensing fees, I'm not positive, but I can get that for you.
And Madam Chair, just to note that the fee increase in this bill mirrors what we looked at in the last time we addressed this issue, and I don't know when it was, but it's been a number of years, and I'm obviously very interested in hearing the industry's take on the fee increase, and you know, not that I have a problem with the fee increase, but I think it's a issue that needs to be aired publicly.
Absolutely, thank you. All right. Any other questions? It looks like we're getting some information from the audience.
Madam Chair, I was just informed last time the licensing fees were increased was 1979.
79, 30 years ago. Okay. I have one question from you, Don. So you're looking at some amendments, and if you were to get these amendments, then you feel that the counties would be able to support this bill?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Great, thank you. Okay, thank you very much. And now I'll have Beth Slater and Lauren Rhodes and Megan Moyer. Good, thanks. And as soon as you sit down, just start talking. If you're first sitting down, you're first talking.
So go.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer, and I'm here representing the members of the Service Employee International Union Local 503, which for this bill are both nursing home employees as well as adult foster care providers. I have participated in Representative Gelser's work group from the February session to this point, and believe that we've made a lot of progress in our conversation. Some of you may remember there were some concerns on our part about some of the provisions from the February bill, and feel comfortable that we've made significant progress on addressing some of those issues as relates to workforce, and working to make a few amendments with Representative Gelser. But this bill is an important step forward in addressing a very serious issue within the DD community, and an issue that our providers feel very strongly needs to be addressed, that this bill will put in both a way for consumers to find information that is relevant in making decisions, as well as create a fund to help improve and prevent future abuse, which is one of our top priorities, is the creation of the Quality Care Fund and its use in helping providers address issues and become better providers. As you all know from previous issues coming from in front of this committee, that we have a shortage of people providing long-term care for people with disabilities in Oregon. And we need to make sure that we work with providers to be the quality providers that they should be. That not only do we need to have a stick, but we need to have a carrot. We need to work with people to be the kind of providers that they need to be. One of our major issues in regards to adult foster care, we're at the bargaining table with the state, and one of the things that is a key proposal from our perspective is enhanced training for adult foster care providers. We want to be the best providers we can be. We are currently limited in what's available to us and hope to work with the department both through contract negotiations and through these initiatives to make sure that providers have access to the training they need to be quality providers. So I'm going to turn it over to Lauren to talk about some of our shared concerns in regards to
fees. Thank you, Megan.
Concerns for support. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Lauren Rhodes with the Oregon Healthcare Association. I'd like to first make sure that we acknowledge Representative Gelser and all of her leadership and support in this issue. This has been a long time in the making, and we've been supportive of provisions of her bill from the very first days, which I think were long before last February. But to date, we've worked closely with her and have appreciated all of her efforts and constant communication and updates and flexibility in making sure that this is a good piece of legislation that meets the needs of the providers and the consumers. And obviously, this is a large bill with a lot of populations impacted, but for our perspective, the long-term care providers are a small component of it in that the provisions that increase the licensing fees and the civil penalties on long-term care facilities will go into creating a supporting the database that is a big part of this bill, but will also enhance and improve the overall quality of care provided in the long-term care community by establishing a dedicated fund, using the funds to support providers through training and technical assistance, ongoing quality initiatives, and really improving the overall quality delivered in the state. We do support keeping the license fees and the civil penalties in statute in order to maintain an appropriate relationship between the violation and the penalty assessed, and acknowledge that there has been many years since these fees were last increased, so this is an appropriate step at this point in time, and look forward to working with Representative Gelser in the amendment process and also answering any questions or concerns that you all might have. Thank you.
Thank you, Lauren.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth Slater, and I'm representing Providence Health and Services today. We appreciate the ability to testify in favor of House Bill 2442. Representative Gelser has done good work in this area, and we really appreciate it. Providence Elder Place is part of Providence Network of Services. They provide adult foster care services. Elder and disabled Oregonians in nursing facilities and adult foster care homes often are among the most vulnerable people in our population. They deserve the best care that providers can offer, and as do those in other residential facilities. Quality assurance is an important tool in this regard, and we appreciate that the fees are directed exclusively to that work. Although the economy is tough for these providers, it makes sense to help pay for quality assurance through fees. We hope the fees remain reasonable going forward. We appreciate that the new fee structure for adult foster care homes is lower than other proposals. Many of these homes are small or independent operators, and they cannot afford large and new expenses at this time. So any consideration you can give to them would be great. We want to ask that expenses are not increased to the point that smaller independent operators would struggle to stay in business. The state needs every community provider, especially in behavioral health. Providence is a member of the Oregon Healthcare Association, and we would like to just reiterate their points about their concerns about keeping fees in statute, that license fees should be targeted at ensuring high standards of quality, and penalties for serious violations should be targeted at ensuring high standards of quality. Thank you,
Beth. And I noticed that you, at least you have it on your computer. If you would give us your written testimony, if you can give it to staff, that would be really helpful for us to keep it in our files as we follow this bill through. Thank you. Any questions? Yes, Representative Huffman.
Thank you. Lauren, maybe you said it and I just missed it. 1,182% increase. What is that really? Can you give us some numbers? I mean, that seems like a proposed beer tax increase to me. It seems large. I mean, what are we comparing here?
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, I believe you are referencing the increase in fees on assisted living facilities and residential care facilities.
That's correct.
Currently, those fees are $30 a year, and so the proposal would be to create a uniform license fee structure across the nursing facility, assisted living, and residential care facility community, and so it would be bringing those up to the same level that the nursing facilities pay in order to support the overall state licensing activities. So we're talking about from $30 to, and I'm trying to find that same paper that you're referencing, but I believe it's $180 or $260 a year. So it's a sizable increase in the percentage change, but in the actual dollar amount, fairly minimal. And also, again, as Representative Maurer acknowledged, many years in the making.
And maybe someone can get us those figures before our next meeting. That would be great.
I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you.
And your clients are good with the change?
Chair Tomei, Representative Huffman, we've worked very closely with our members, and they feel very comfortable with the increase in the license fees in keeping them in statute in order to maintain that level of uniformity, yes.
Representative Maurer.
Madam Chair, quickly, it seems like you still treat a one-bed facility the same as you treat a 15-bed facility. And is there below on this little sheet, you have a per-bed fee. And just seems a little inequitable.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer. The difference is in the way that the license fees are assessed on adult foster care homes is on a per-bed basis, and that's because they're limited in the number of beds that they can, the number of clients they can serve is up to five. So it's $20 a bed, so it would be a maximum of $100 license fee. The same is not the case in long-term care facilities where we came up with, or it's currently in statute, in a range of beds. So it's 1 to 15, 15 to 49 or 50. I'm sorry, I don't have it in front of me. But I think the difference is that the proportionality, the impact on small providers serving five or fewer clients versus larger providers who serve multiple members of clients. So the per bed basis is only on the adult foster care homes. And
Madam Chair, I understand that, but I'm saying it doesn't. It seems to me a per bed charge might be a more equitable fashion to apportion the licensing fees. I'm throwing it. I'm not. It's just that's what my gut reaction is, and I don't know if that was considered.
Maybe that's something you could.
I mean, how many one-bed facilities are there?
None.
No, okay.
That's not true.
Okay.
That's not true. Actually, relative adult foster care providers provide for one person, but they normally. So there are
the family. Yes,
there are residential, technically a residential facility of one.
And those are licensed?
Yes, they are.
Okay. And question. Those would be the facilities I have concern about with the $360.
Representative Huffman, then let's see, Representative Van Orman, and Representative... Oh, okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not volunteering for a work group, but this does parallel what we talked about the other day with child care, and just echoing what Representative Maurer said, I like the per bed because it's more equitable, and I would just encourage some looking at that type of a system because, you know, you can't have that breaking point at 15, and you've got somebody that has... 12 people and somebody that has 35, and it's just, I think per bed should be looked at.
And so maybe Representative Kelser, thank you. Yes, please come up.
Thank you. For the record, I'm still Representative Sarah Gelser. The issue of the fees and how they impact each facility is something that has been exhaustively discussed by all of the parties that are involved in it, including the individuals who will be paying the fees. And I am certainly happy to have further discussion. I would just point out that this was a very difficult discussion to have, and we had small providers, large providers, relative foster care providers. Everyone that's paying them is comfortable with them and feels that it's been a fair proposal that has come forward. So happy to do further work if the committee wants that. But I would just point out it's been arduous work to get everyone to a place where people are comfortable with the structure and the way it's been put together.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 31 of HB 2442, it talks about, in section 25, lines 23 through 27, it talks about the annual license fee for 1 to 15 is 180, and more than 150, the annual license fee shall be 750. So it has a graduated fee basis on beds. So then on page 33, section 31, we have lines 24 through 32, again talking about fees, and so I've been trying to quickly read what's the difference between the two, if you could explain, please.
Chair Tomei, Representative Van Orman. The difference is that nursing facilities are assessed an annual license fee. Assisted living and residential care facilities are assessed a biannual license fee. So that's simply a two-year number versus a one-year dollar amount. So it's double.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so sections, follow-up. So section 28 through 32 is the doubling. It goes from 180 to 360.
Chair Tomei, Representative Norman, yes, for assisted living facilities
okay. And
residential care facilities, it's doubled because they're assessed every 2 years as opposed to on an annual basis.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much. And we'll call up Andrea Meyer, Bob Jundiff, and Mary Boston. And whoever gets here first can start talking first. Andrea, I think you were first.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I am here to speak about some concerns specifically with Section 6, the fingerprint criminal history background checks of House Bill 2442. I don't normally say as a personal note, and I will because I know there's a lot of hard work that's gone in this bill, and ACLU is most of this isn't our issue. I had a grandmother in a nursing home for over 15 years with Alzheimer's, so I come from all perspectives. But we have likewise always been involved in issues around criminal history and fingerprint checks in the Oregon statute since it began in 1993. And my boss got to work on that, and I inherited it as I took over. The original origins was around teachers and schools and students, and in 2005, as some of you have already heard me testify in this session, because I think there are more fingerprint criminal history bills this session than ever, little separate ones, we worked with Representative Cameron and a bunch of other folks on House Bill 2157, which was a huge omnibus bill of many agencies, departments, setting up systems and requirements for criminal history background checks with the FBI, fingerprints taken. And what was critically important for the ACLU and what is reflected in this law is a number of safeguards in place, and they're also reflected in the TSPC and the Department of Education, which was one of the first. And DHS has also been doing this for a very long time as well. And one of those safeguards is that the fingerprints sent to the FBI of people who have no criminal history are not retained by anyone. In fact, the statute requires that there be assurances from the FBI that they are not keeping fingerprints. And likewise, they go back either to the Oregon State Police and they are destroyed or back to the individual. That is a critical safeguard for us because we do not want government possessing fingerprints of individuals who have never been convicted of a crime, innocent people. And unfortunately, this provision in Section 6 begins to move us away from that by allowing fingerprint records to be retained if the individual consents. Now, I understand the reason. It's particularly costs and the increased costs, and this will provide a reduction in only one part. It doesn't cover the cost of actually getting the criminal history, but just obtaining the fingerprints. I understand that. We are sympathetic to that, but we think too important is the principle that's been through all the fingerprint criminal history bills in the past 16 years, which is that they cannot be retained. While it's framed that the individual has the choice, that still makes us very uncomfortable. I understand that the proponents were trying to balance that privacy and consent issue, but nevertheless, the government would be retaining them. Law enforcement and others would have access to them. And even if there were a prohibition added to that, I don't believe we have the systems and the safeguards set up for retention of fingerprints. And we would urge that that part be removed. If what I've experienced, and for many of you who've been around, when we make a change to one statute, we sort of make an exception, and often there's very good reasons, that exception eventually becomes the rule. And so we feel very strongly that we need to say here that this would be a significant problem. The other issue that I want to raise is the concern in Section 6, again, about the list of crimes that are an outright ban on employment. Again, very sensitive to the issues and what's the purpose around this. And it is true that I believe TSPC and maybe the Department of Education, but the Education do have a list. I don't know if it's this list. We've opposed that because we think there does need to be context. The Department of Human Services has been doing this for a very long time, and they actually have very thorough OARs taking into account many factors. And I don't believe they've had issues arise around this. I think for the most case, they actually never hire someone with a sexual assault abuse history of any kind. But we need to remember that sometimes with this list of crime here, which goes beyond sexual related crimes, people at a young age do really stupid things. Sometimes they do minor stupid things, and sometimes they do more serious stupid things. But some of these crimes listed here include misdemeanors. If they have worked successfully for the last 30 years and have a history of employment, and again, the department is required to look at a significant number of factors, we don't believe there should be an outright prohibition. But again, and the department can speak to about how it does its balancing, the more recent time, the lack of any change. I mean, all these factors, it's a huge list in the OARs. And we think that's critically important for the concept of rehabilitation. And we start, again, undoing it, and we don't like the exception in the schools. And again, very compelling reason here. I mean, these are vulnerable folks, so I understand the reason. But again, providing this blanket prohibition without any context of 30 or 40 years having passed makes us very concerned. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions, and I appreciate the opportunity today. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrea. Mary?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Mary Bachman with the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, and we are offering our support with the amendments as proposed by Representative Gelser. And for those of you who went through the February session with Representative Gelser, and I just want to state for the record that we do not see any constitutional challenges with this bill at this point, nor do we see any hiring problems. Other than ones that we have said in the past, and I will continue to say, and that is, this industry is severely underpaid. They receive virtually no benefits. They get trained to care for the most vulnerable citizens in our society, and they get to go through background checks and criminal history checks, and at the end of all that, they get the dubious honor of working for minimum wage or barely above. And that, in our opinion, needs to change, fundamentally change. And we need to take a look at how we reimburse and compensate the folks who are working in this industry to make it a profession rather than a job. And that, unfortunately, will fall upon you as legislators, and even in tough times, I will remind the committee that for these folks who work in this industry, times are even tougher. And I think that Representative Gelser has done a fine job of sort of moving the training up to a higher degree and requiring more standardized training. We think that's great. We think the Quality Care Commission is a good idea. And the amendments will fix all of our local government concerns at this point. And so, again, we're offering our support at this point. But I would be remiss as an advocate for the people that we represent who work in this industry if I did not, again, remind the committee of the importance of linking some of the work that these folks do to a reasonable salary and benefit structure that fairly compensates them for the arduous work that they do and brings this industry into a profession rather than a job. You know, you can get a job at McDonald's. This is not, you know, we should not be competing with the same workforce. We should really, really look at this as a profession that we are proud to encourage.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
Bob?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junduff. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. Disability Rights Oregon came into being in 1977 as part of a national network in response to abuse and neglect of people with developmental disabilities in large institutions across the nation, including in Oregon. So we've been actively involved in these issues for over 30 years. This is, by its nature, this is a problem that continues with us, and we must continually pay attention to it. Unfortunately, as Ms. Botkin just noted, the salaries being what they are, the pay being what they are, and the training being what it is, we must constantly be looking for creative ways to address the vulnerability of the population and assuring their safety. And that is why I'm here today to praise Representative Gelser. I believe that this bill, as it's been negotiated out by getting all the parties to the table, including our organization, really comes up with some very positive steps that can improve the lives of people with disabilities. And doing that in a time of fiscal restraint is particularly remarkable. And so Representative Gelser deserves our praise for the energy and effort that she's brought into what I think are very reasonable. They're modest, but I think can be effective steps to improve safety for people in our residential facilities. And I know that you're limited on time. I've put down some bullet points in my written testimony about the types of things that I believe have been proven to be effective in improving safety for folks in facilities, and so I'll leave it at that unless you have any questions.
Thank you. Any questions of this panel?
Right.
Well, I think Representative Van Orman had a question. I'll get to you, Representative Maurer, and Representative Olson, you have a question?
I do.
Yes, okay. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the questions I have for you, Andrea, is about the lists. There are multiple lists of crimes and multiple agencies that are using these lists. Do you know how many lists are out there?
Chair Tomei, Representative Van Orman, if you mean lists in the rulemaking, which is where I've seen these lists for the most part, no. I am concerned about the list and the standards being put in place to have that evaluation. Every agency seems to be doing it differently because of the 2157 this fall, and I cannot remember the entity, and maybe that's for the best, sent me their draft regs, and I didn't have a chance to look at them until they were done, but they basically, and I read them and went, they said, well, the list of crimes is in our policy manual, I think, and the other one, I believe, was in our evaluation process is in our policy manual, and I wrote them and suggested that that did not seem to be in compliance with ORS 181, I think 534, and urged them to review that. So I'm very concerned. Most seem to be doing any crime, any misdemeanor, any felony, but then having the nexus and the evaluation of time, rehabilitation, age of the crime, all those things, employment history. So I'm not sure I fully answered your question, and I haven't surveyed it.
Well, quick follow-up. Yes, because I know that the Employment Division has a list. I've been on the Criminal History Registry because I've gone through my criminal investigation. And so it does concern me. How many different lists are we creating? Perhaps at some point in time, there's another bill for you.
Chair Tomei, Representative Van Orman, and at least with those lists, they are not rigid in terms of if you've had this crime, you may never have employment. Some will naturally be that case when they look at the criminal history. The agency will say never. But I simply wanted to note one of these on the list that's in here that's a outright prohibition is unauthorized use of a vehicle, fraudulent use of a credit card, which can be a misdemeanor, mail theft or receipt of stolen mail, which can be a misdemeanor. And some of those are done by adults who should not be employed. Some of those are done by 17, 18, 19-year-olds who 30 years later should not be punished if they have gone the straight path and have worked successfully for many years. So,
Andrea, did I ask you to give us anything in writing? Did I ask you, if not, would you do that for us? Just one pager we can put in our file
sure.
to reference.
Thank you. Chair Tomei, I'm more than happy to do that. Thank
Representative
you.
Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I guess, Andrea, the only problem I have is the inconsistency with the issue of consent of the employee. In one argument, in another bill, in another committee, we need consent. And here, where the bill specifically says consent, participate in this, and now you're opposing that. I just...
Sure. Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, and I use this term very broadly. I look at this as potential of coercion. It may be because it's financially easier. It may be because they're strongly encouraged. I'm not suggesting there's intent around it to say, but, you know, people and folks often don't protect... We all have different levels of concerns about our privacy. And as you know, a younger generation puts all their information on Facebook, having no understanding of the repercussions this may have for college or career. So at some point, you know, part of the role of government is to ensure those boundaries are in place. And historically, one of these has been the bright line with the fingerprints and not retaining them, despite the ease to which they could be used later. So in this context, And I'm happy to talk to you in the hallway, as we often do, a little bit more about the other issues where we talk about consent, but whether this is truly independent, meaningful consent, or if there's not some financial or other hook that makes it more compelling to say, it's easier to say yes, and I'm going to trust the government or whatever entity is possessing these to keep these There's no bar. I mean, law enforcement can always get things like this. Even if you write it in here, they can get a court order. The FBI with a security letter can come in and get it. We feel really strongly about not creating a resource or a location or a place where these are retained. Even if people say, sure, I have nothing to hide, it's when government gets it wrong, and Brandon Mayfield is our example when it comes to fingerprints, that government can get it wrong sometimes. So,
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions, and they're both kind of short.
Madam Chair, I had one quick follow-up.
I'm sorry. He's not coming with me.
I apologize. There's, you know, everybody says, or not everybody, some people say, I'm a card-carrying member of the ACLU. Is there actually a card?
Yeah. Okay. Representative Maurer, it is, and it's only $20 for an individual, and we do not disclose our membership, so I'm certainly happy to expedite your anonymous card. If you have an
offer, I'm a member. Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rumor has it you might be an NRA card carrier as well.
Chair Tomei,
no,
Representative Olson. Rumors are what they are.
Andrea, two quick questions. One deals, getting back to Section 6, which identifies what the crimes are that would be entered into the database. Mm-hmm. You touched on it a little bit. I'm curious your thoughts along the idea of expungement with this. The database.
Chair Tomei, Representative Olson, I know you've been working with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association on that issue, and unfortunately they're probably well-versed on that. I think that obviously is a dynamic that should always be filtered into it, and I appreciate you recognizing that dynamic's at play potentially here, because if expungement is truly expungement, it needs to be meaningful. So I hope, and I'm happy to turn it over to the OCDLA to work with you on that aspect as you all come to discussions with that big issue.
And I would hope that if people have other issues that they want to discuss with Andrea, that they will
see you in the hallway.
Yes, see her in the hallway, ask her to come and visit you, whatever. Thank you. Is there anyone else here to testify on this bill? Representative, yes, Gelser, please come up. Please, thank you so much for testifying. And
Madam Chair.
Really?
Is this
Brian DeLashman? Yeah, for this bill?
I signed up on the wrong bill.
Okay. Do you wish to speak on this bill?
Just very briefly.
Sure. Yeah. Stay there. All right. Representative Gelson.
For the record, Brian DeLashman, representing the Community Providers Association of Oregon. With me is Mike Oliver, the legislative chair. Just wanted to touch on three very quick points. One is we do appreciate the work that Representative Gelser has done. This bill's come a long ways. A couple of things that we originally were concerned about have been taken care of. The first is the consistency in the investigations from county to county. That was a huge concern for us. Also, the protection of the employers if they give information to another potential employer, that is huge for us as well. The one additional piece that we're still trying to work through is the use of data going back to 2003 on the database when you are changing the information that you're collecting so that you're using a different standard for what goes on the reports, and then you're going back to 2003. We're concerned about mixing up the apples and the oranges there, but we'll continue to work with that.
Thank you, Brian.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Oliver. For purposes of brevity today, I think you probably heard and Brian summarized well the issues of our group. And for the record, our group, like the Oregon Rehabilitation Association, does provide direct services for-profit, non-profit providers, children and adults statewide. And as you can well imagine, second time around on these issues, we're very encouraged that, this body is again considering ways to actually help us in the provider community provide better services, stay on top of issues that are critically important in terms of the types of outcomes people receive as a result and the types of individuals that we're serving. I think you've heard today from everybody prior to us us kind of a consensus on the themes. And again, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but I do think for our group, one of the very significant issues that we wrestle with on a daily basis has been the consistency county to county, region to region in the state of the entire protective services system, primarily the one involving adults with developmental disabilities. And so with that said, I think in the spirit of your time and not really wanting to necessarily rehash any issues, I will go ahead and volunteer the mic to Representative Gelser again, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, both of you. And if you have anything you'd like to put in writing, always one-page bullet
yes.
points are very welcome. That would be helpful for us to have in our file. Representative Gelser, do you think people have come here to testify on 2444 who have come from out of town? I feel
Madam
really
Chair,
bad.
I do not believe so, and for
okay.
the record, 2444 was split off of this, and it's a nice idea, but we don't have the money to do it.
Well, that sums it up.
Okay,
well,
you know
where
I'm
that
not
one is.
Worry about that one. Go ahead.
Good
then.
Bill won't pass this session, but it will be back, perhaps with Representative Huffman. I wanted to quickly make a quick clarifying point on the Section 6. The first thing is, Chair Tomei and others, the information in Section 6 does not go into the database. Criminal history information is not in that searchable database. That is just about the substantiated abuses. The other thing that's important in Section 6, if you have had your record expunged because it is something that you did in your youthful indiscretion and you've gone back and you have petitioned the judge to have that removed in the interest of justice, that comes out, you're no longer prohibited. If your record is expunged from that crime, it no longer exists, and you could then be hired if a judge has granted you that expungement. So I think that is a very important clarification. And then finally, on the list of crimes, you'll find very major crimes where a previous witness mentioned a misdemeanor. These are specifically around elder abuse and elder issues where you have financial fraud, identity theft that happens when you're stealing mail, when you're fraudulently using the credit card of the person that you're supposed to be providing care for, where you're forging their checks. This population is extraordinarily vulnerable to that type of situation, and that's why this is in here, to provide those important protections to these elderly folks who have money and the very little money that people with developmental disabilities have.
So if I could clarify then, so the 17-year-old who has taken her mother's credit card and fraudulently used it, this would not apply to her. It would only apply when someone was using a credit card of someone in their care. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I do not know that that is correct, but the 17-year-old who has gone and done that and as a teenager has been convicted of a crime is very likely to go back and ask to have that record sealed or expunged, and in that case it would not apply.
Thank you. And I would hope that you'd be meeting with Andrea so we can deal with some of these issues that apparently she has questions about.
Yes, Madam Chair. Today was the first time that I had heard that there were concerns from Andrea, so I will certainly follow up.
Thank you. Any further questions? So you will be coming back to us with amendments that make everybody happy?
Yes, Madam Chair, I will come back with amendments. I don't expect they will make everyone happy, particularly on Section 6. I think that I believe that this prohibition is extraordinarily important. These are very vulnerable people, and I am very uncomfortable making significant changes to that list of prohibited crimes. The other list that other people have done, I think we've been able to accommodate almost every amendment request that has come forward, and I will continue. I believe Oregon Healthcare Association and the Department of Human Services are continuing their discussions about exactly how the civil penalties will work and whether or not there's a cap in the statute regarding that. But I hope to have these and have it ready for you within 10 days.
Wonderful. Thank you. Any further questions of Representative Gelser? Great job. I know how much work that you and all the providers have put in on this. So thank you all for coming today. Thank you for all the work that all of you have put in the many, many hours. And thank you coming to testify. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2442, and I will close the House Committee on Human Services on February 18th, 2009.